This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte.
Today's word on the future, together. Because the future of business isn't driven by what machines or people do alone, but by all they can achieve together. See how we can help at Deloitte.com/US/innovate.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Am I wrong to think that we delighted in living there? No delusions are more familiar than those inspired in the elderly by nostalgia, but am I completely mistaken to think that living as well-born children in Renaissance Florence could not have held a candle to growing up with an aromatic range of Tabachnik's pickle barrels? Am I mistaken to think that even back then, in the vivid present, the fullness of life stirred our emotions to an extraordinary extent? Has anywhere since so engrossed you in its ocean of details? The detail, the immensity of the detail, the force of the detail, the weight of the detail, the rich endlessness of detail surrounding you in your young life like the 6 feet of dirt that'll be packed on your grave when you're dead. Perhaps by definition, a neighborhood is the place to which a child spontaneously gives undivided attention. That's the unfiltered way meaning comes to children, just flowing off the surface of things. Nonetheless, 50 years later, I ask you, has the immersion ever again been so complete as it was in those streets where every block, every backyard, every house, every floor of every house, the walls, ceilings, doors, and windows of every last friend's family apartment came to be so absolutely individualized? Were we ever again to be such keen recording instruments of the microscopic surface of things close at hand, of the minute gradations of social position conveyed by linoleum and oilcloth, by yahrzeit candles and cooking smells, by Ronson table lighters and Venetian blinds? About one another, we knew who had what kind of lunch in the bag in his locker and who ordered what on his hot dog at Sid's. We knew one another's every physical attribute, who walked pigeon-toed and who had breasts, who smelled of hair oil and who over-salivated when he spoke. We knew who among us was belligerent and who was friendly, who was smart and who was dumb. We knew whose mother had an accent and whose father had a mustache, whose mother worked and whose father was dead. Somehow, we even dimly grasped how every family's different set of circumstances set each family a distinctive, difficult human problem.
That's from American Pastoral, which won Roth the Pulitzer Prize. American Pastoral was the first in a trilogy of books about post-war American history. It tackled the chaos of the Vietnam War, I Married a Communist was steeped in the McCarthy era, and The Human Stain looked at the late 90s battles over political correctness and sex. In 2003, I had the privilege of sitting down with Philip for the BBC, and we talked about the trilogy, which is situated, like so many of his books, in and around Newark, New Jersey.
Well, Philip, let's start out by talking about what Newark was and what is it, it's the kind of Arcadia for you, and it has always been in your books. That's where you're from.
Arcadia, and, no, but that's
but a very specific part of Newark. And talk a little bit, I think, to begin about what Newark was as opposed to New York City right across the river.
My orientation as a boy was by no means to New York City, nor did I know anybody in New York City. we had no, our family was spread out, but not, they weren't in New York. So there was no reason ever to go to New York. The only time I ever went to New York as a child was for some birthday celebration or for my parents' anniversary. And where did we go? We went to the Radio City Music Hall to see the Rockettes and went to Chinatown to sinfully eat Chinese food. That was the sinning part of our life. New York was a substantial city, of what, about 250,000 people. It was one of the 15 or so largest cities in America. It had a very vibrant life as an industrial working class city. So who needed New York?
And your family got there the first place. You had Yiddish speaking grandparents, mm-hmm. and your father sold insurance. It was not a bookish house particularly, was it?
We had a book. There were about three books.
Yeah.
I remember them very vividly. I didn't go near them, but I remember they were there. There were books that were given as presents when someone was ill. Do you know? And I'm not saying that to burlesque it. That's a fact.
Right.
No, there were no books.
You once remarked that sheer playfulness and deadly seriousness are my closest friends. What did you mean by that?
I think that's the formula to describe the concoction that energizes virtually any writer worth his or her salt, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The sheer playfulness may also be described as the ability to imagine oneself into a situation which is not necessarily connected to the life you lead whatsoever. Mm-hmm. To let the ball, you know, let the ball bounce, you know, and by itself. The deadly seriousness is another affliction which has to be there. Things have to seem to you to matter a great deal. Mm. I think that the writer tends to have, spiritually, if not outwardly, a moral stake in everything. This could be the timidest person who's, once he or she leaves the desk, is absolutely terrified by everything, doesn't go into the world. Emily Dickinson would be a good example, right? It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. It's at the moment the person is being a writer, should be a tiger of some kind.
You write, you live a certain way. Every day you engage them for I don't know how many hours a day while you're actually at the desk. Mm-hmm. It's the consuming activity of your life. What's it for? Who is it for?
Yeah. You might well ask. I don't know what else to do. I don't know how else to do anything. I can't do anything else. So otherwise I just sit idly in this seat without the television stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do, David. I've been doing it all my life. If it were taken away from me, I think I would die, probably. And without being overly dramatic, I would be emptied.
Is there a sense of mastery at some point that you might not have had at 40?
There's patience.
What did age give you? What did experience give you?
Patience. That is the patience to outlast your frustration. The confidence that if you just stay with it, you'll master it, mm-hmm. you know? But that doesn't mean tomorrow necessarily. But that, I think it gives you confidence in your instincts and that those spontaneous activities I spoke of earlier. You don't feel like such a gambler, such a risk taker in laying down the first 10 or 20 or 50 pages. So I guess age or experience give you patience, confidence. But the confidence can be shattered at the end of a first draft. Probably any work where you start with nothing on a page and you have to fill the page is accompanied by a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear. That fear is simply you can't do it. And frustration as you're doing it, because what comes is very crude. But over the years, I think what you develop is a tolerance for your own crudeness and patience with your own crap, really, and a kind of belief in your crap, which is just stay with your crap and it'll get better if you just stay with it and come back every day and keep going. But it's a living. It's turned out to be, as I make about as good living as a New York dermatologist. And the difference is that he's been making it for longer than I have.
Philip, you had the experience of going back and reading these three books this last week.
Mm-hmm.
Preparation just for our talk. Mm-hmm. What was it like to read your own books?
I haven't read these books in a while. I can't honestly say I was displeased by what I read. I saw my own method, you know?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean, I guess it's like watching the videos of the game where you had five for six at bats, you know? And you see your swing. I saw that what I'd staked everything on was density.
Density of?
Surface. Give you a painting analogy. Jackson Pollock's big paintings, which I think are marvelous and wonderful. Everything, it's covered. They're covered.
Mm-hmm.
And they're covered with energy. They're covered with pictorial substance, too, which is the paint. They're covered, as we know, with energy. And they're completely covered. And it's dramatized in every square inch somehow. That's the amazing thing. As opposed to, say, Mark Rothko. Mm-hmm. It's also covered. But it's covered in a different way. And what I felt was a kind of affinity in these three books in terms of the compositional struggle and solution to those big Pollock paintings, that I tried to cover every square inch with real stuff. The other thing is, I wish I could know what this guy knows. I think I could make a life out of this.
Mm-hmm.
That is, there's a knowledge that the writing produces that is not your knowledge. It's produced by the demands of the narrative. And lo and behold, there's knowledge there.
Mm.
Or wisdom even, of all things. It's not yours.
As a reader rather than in a different way.
Well, I know I don't know these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not trying to be cute or precious or whatever. It comes of the activity. So when Jackson Pollock isn't painting, he doesn't know anything but how to drink. When I'm not writing, I don't know anything either.
Philip Roth. That interview was recorded for the BBC in 2003.
You fight your superficiality, your shallowness, so as to try to come at people without unreal expectations, without an overload of bias or hope or arrogance. As untank-like as you can be, sans cannon and machine guns and steel plating half a foot thick. You come at them unmenacingly on your own 10 toes. Instead of tearing up the turf with your caterpillar treads, take them on with an open mind, as equals, man to man, as we used to say, and yet you never fail to get them wrong. You might as well have the brain of a tank. You get them wrong before you meet them, while you're anticipating meeting them. You get them wrong while you're with them, and then you go home to tell somebody else about the meeting, and you get them all wrong again. Since the same generally goes for them with you, the whole thing is really a dazzling illusion. The fact remains that getting people right is not what living is all about anyway. It's getting them wrong that is living. Getting them wrong and wrong and wrong, and then on careful reconsideration, getting them wrong again. That's how we know we're alive. We're wrong. Maybe the best thing would be to forget about being right or wrong about people and just go along for the ride. But if you can do that, well, lucky you.
That passage was from American Pastoral, read by Liev Schreiber.
Support for today's show comes from Deloitte. What does the future look like? By melding business acumen and innovative technology, Deloitte can help you build the future only you can imagine. They can help engineer solutions for your business reality today and your vision for tomorrow to get you to a world where you don't just dream it, you build it. See how you can engineer advantage with Deloitte at deloitte.com/us/engineeringadvantage.